This is the August 28 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Matt Bennett of AgMarket.net. We're joined by Arlen Suderman with StoneX, and Colin Waters is here. He is with the Illinois Corn Growers Association. Our program comes to you today from the Farm Progress Show in Decatur, Illinois. Remember, you can always find Commodity Week online on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. Arlen Suderman, let's begin with you for the day. You've spent 3 days here at the Farm Progress Show in Decatur. You and Matt and a few others have been in the varied industries tent, and I want Matt's take on this too. What have farmers been asking you most often?
Well, it all comes down to the size of the corn crop, the size of the soybean crop, and whether we're going to sell soybeans to China. I think those are the three big things, that's the focus. And when are we, have we put the bottom in the market? That's what everybody wants to know.
And Matt Bennett, are they asking you the same question or something different?
Yeah, they're asking, when's the corn market going to rally? I mean, that's the first question I get asked. So,
do you tell them it already has a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I tell them whenever you take a report like the August one, which is arguably one of the most bearish reports I've ever seen in my life, and you take these corn down on the week a quarter of a penny, that would be called a win in my book. And so, there's various reasons that we can go into as to why, I kind of feel like the market's acted like it has, but absolutely, things could look worse than what they do right now.
They could look worse. I do want to hear about a conversation I think both of you heard or talked with Scott Irwin, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois, about. This has to do with farm policy, particularly coming out of Washington, D.C. and the EPA. SREs, or the small refinery exemptions, aren't quite set, but it sounded to me, and I'll start here, Matt, with you and on this, that Scott, and we've heard this on the radio from him already on Thursday afternoon, but Scott really is pretty bullish the soybeans over time as it's related to biofuels and the crush. Can you tell me about that conversation you had with him?
Yeah, and so I actually came to this, drove by the tent and saw Scott out. I said, I better stop and talk to him. And after we talked about Illinois football and some other stuff, in the fact that
Schnitke was not there to talk about
our
Ohio
expectations
State.
Expectations are so high, which is very scary as an Illinois football fan.
Before you get into the rest of the story, and maybe you will have made note of this too, because you're a University of Illinois grad, this summer, when I have been out at the State Fair and Farm Progress Show and all the other events, there are more University of Illinois Illini hats and shirts out than I have seen in decades, and
it has
to do with the sports teams.
No, absolutely. I mean, we've got good athletic programs all the way around, but as you know, Todd, the best thing for an Illini football team is low expectations, because when they're high, it doesn't always pan out for us, but I'm a huge Bilema fan. Coach, he's doing a good job there. But, so I stopped talking to Scott, and we had a great conversation, and I was getting ready to leave. He said, whoa. He said, we need to talk. And I said, about what? He said, basically, I'm bullish soybean oil. I said, yeah, I am too. He said, no, I'm bullish soybean oil. And I said, yeah, I get it. And so no doubt about it, when you look at the policy right now, clearly everything isn't set in stone, but everything we're getting is actually very friendly. And so bottom line, over the course of time, the build out of the crush industry is not going to happen overnight, but there will be reason for it. There will be profit margin. I mean, the crush margins are still good even today, and they should get a lot better if soybean oil goes in the direction that we think it's going to go, which would be a fair amount higher than where we sit today. But bottom line is, Scott's very friendly.
From the StoneX side, and you have deep roots into the industry from StoneX, what do we know, understand about the policy and how it works, and how do you see this playing out? Are you as bullish as Scott is, and how long of a horizon?
Yeah, our edible oils team is very friendly to soy oil demand. When we look at the policies that have been released so far, they've been very farmer-friendly on the biofuel side. And I think a big reason for that is the Trump administration trying to find other areas to support agriculture during the tariff war. When we look at what we know so far, the two big questions that have not yet been answered has been the offsets for the SREs that were granted, small refinery exemptions. How many of those will have to be made up by the larger refineries? And at this point, we believe that even if there are no offsets, that's still friendly for demand. The other piece of the equation is the 50% credit, RIN credit, for foreign or from overseas feedstocks. And that's one that farmers obviously cheered when it went down to 50% to try to favor domestic feedstocks. The big oil really opposed that, and the reason is they're worried we don't have enough feedstock. And that may be one we have to give on, because if we lose big oil support, they're very invested in this industry, that could end up hurting us. So I do think that we're tight on feedstock. That may be one that we see some change. Maybe it goes to 75%. Maybe it goes to 100%. I don't know. But right now, the two remaining things that are left, we still feel it's going to be bullish for soy oil demand. The big problem is getting enough crush built. Right now, USDA has their crush number for the next marketing year about as high as it can be with the existing crush capacity. So we need to get more built. That's going to take a year or two to do. But in the long run, this is going to be very friendly, I think, for soybeans.
Yesterday, I was talking to a producer from Mitchell, South Dakota. They are apparently putting a new crush plant up there, so capacity is still being brought on board. Do you think those crushing plants that were planned but that were paused or stopped, will they come back on board quickly now?
Yeah, we do see most of those coming on board. It's just restarting, jump-starting everything, and that's in the process now. It just takes that time to build it, but at least they're that far along. So that'll make it quicker than if they had to start from scratch.
Arlen Suderman, of course, is with StoneX. Colin Waters is here, too. He's with the Illinois Corn Growers Association. I know you have these policy things in the back of your mind as they're related to corn. We've been talking about soybeans, but it's not the only part of this. The SREs, of course, are there. That has to do with ethanol. E15, potentially, as a year-round function. What are the things that you've been watching, and what might they mean for demand?
So I guess one of the things that we tend to think about, and this actually gets back to some of the work that Scott has done in the past, is, you know, the SREs, yes, it's really, really important. It's really more important on the ethanol, on the plant profitability side. Some of the work that he's done has basically shown that there really isn't a correlation with the SREs and overall corn demand, right? So from a farmer perspective, kind of keep that in mind. We tend to get wrapped around the axle on SREs and a lot of that policy. But, E15 is definitely something that needs to be done. In the grand scheme of things, I'm not sure that, addressing the patchwork issues that we have right now, if that will really generate true demand, like significant demand, right? I think there's a misconception that you go to E15, well, that'll just 50% more ethanol, right? Well, no, not really, because in some of these markets where E15 is still allowed and you don't need a waiver and all that, it really hasn't penetrated as much as you would think. There's other impediments, right? So it's stuff like underground tank warranties and equipment.
Having to install the pump.
It's incredibly complicated, right? So it's not like you just flip a switch when you say E15 is all good, done and done, and we're going to have 50% more corn demand. That's not the case.
And the big orange warning label that says E15, I doubt, is very helpful, only because of the color of the darn thing.
Yeah, and what's really interesting to me is that you're now seeing a lot of stations that they're selling the 87 octane, but it's E15, right? And so if you need E10, you got to pay for the premium. You got to get 93, right, or 91. So there are some changes happening in the marketplace, but it's not an across the board thing. So anyways, I, I think that, you know, right now the way that we're looking at it is that, in, you know, 2019 was really kind of the high watermark for ethanol demand in the United States, and we've kind of plateaued. It looks like we're going to probably, absent any sort of major policy change, that we will see a slow erosion of domestic ethanol demand.
And Colin or Arlen, and I don't know who will be better at this, on the SREs going forward, it's not a completely done deal as it goes to policy just yet, because it's not quite clear if they will be required to be picked up by the large producers, so there will be a reallocation of them. But if they are reallocated, that could, I believe, if I remember the conversation with Scott correctly, cause some kind of demand push.
Yeah, certainly so. We expect that. And for what the EPA has ruled on so far, there's about 1.4 billion RINs that are affected that are up for, are they going to be reallocated? But that doesn't include the applications for 2025. So you add those two, and it gets to about 2 billion RINs that would be divided up among the various fuels and stuff. So we anticipate the EPA to release several different options that's at the OMB now or going to the OMB now, and then it'll come for a public comment. Maybe a ruling by the end of October. That may be squeezing the calendar a little bit. That's the big thing now, is when are we going to have some certainty? We believe it's going to be positive for demand. But again, it's uncertain, and the market's kind of trading that uncertainty now until we know more, and it's going to be another couple months probably before we really do.
Okay, Matt, back to what producers have been telling you here at the Farm Progress Show from across the Midwest as they've been walking through. Are they talking about the variability in the crop, or are they simply telling you, you know, actually I have a really good crop?
You know, I would say the most common thing I'm hearing, and this is a multi-state conversation, is that my crop was phenomenal, but now it's really good. We have not had a good finish in August. And so, you know, I've tried to tell people, hey, I'm not trying to get bullish on you. What I'm trying to impress upon you is that we started with incredible potential, and now... like, for instance, on my farm, you know, my yard's brown. And so what's that tell you? I didn't finish well. And so clearly, whenever you have mid-May planted corn that's already dented, you know, you brought it along too quickly. And you're not going to have that good finish you really want to see with big test weights and corn that weighs really good. Disease is certainly going to be a factor. A good friend of mine went through Iowa yesterday and had several stops, and said he didn't have one stop without significant rust issues. And most of these fields were sprayed. Now, whether it's going to have a large yield impact, depending upon, you know, a lot of that rust is below the ear in some places, so you don't know. I mean, it's lower in the plant if it's really going to affect things. But, yeah, Todd, I think the most common thing I've heard is that, you know, I was looking at maybe a 260, 270 type yield. Now it's probably 20, 30 below that, which is still awfully good corn. And so there's a lot to be learned here still. I think that whenever you look at the crop size in total, I'm certainly well below the USDA's August number. But at the same time, I'm still in the camp that it's very likely to be a record crop, something north of 180. I just don't know if it's as far north of 180 as what some people feel.
Grain fill, of course, is about light interception. So if it's below the ear, less so than clearly if it is above right. The ear, and how much photosynthesis is able to be done. What have you heard? Kind of the same thing as it's related to the size of this crop?
Yeah, certainly so. And I think one of the things that I've noticed as I've been crisscrossing the Midwest here over the last few weeks is how many top leaves are burning a lot of fields. That's never good to see that burning, starting from the top going down. And so we definitely are taking some of the top off. It's still a big crop. It's still going to give us some storage issues, especially in the western Midwest. The Dakotas have a record crop regardless, and they deserve having a good yeah. crop up there. But it's not what it was, certainly.
The man from Mitchell, South Dakota, told me 200 or better for his corn crop, and Mitchell's not exactly in the eastern side of South Dakota,
no,
I mean, and or on the best of ground, I would think.
Well, I mean, you get in that southeast of Sioux Falls area, and east of Sioux Falls, and that's just as good a dirt as what we're
right.
looking at around here. A lot of that, some of those guys have pulled off 240s and 250s in the last few years. But yeah, you go west of Sioux Falls, it changes significantly.
I was surprised when he was pretty straightforward, honest about it. He was like, I have a good crop. I have a really good crop. Okay, Colin, he mentioned Darlin did logistics. And I want to hear, because this is in your wheelhouse, about the logistics related to storing this crop. Soybeans not going out of North Dakota are a problem throughout the Midwest. Is that correct?
Sure. I mean, anything that will kind of upset the entire system. I mean, I think the logistics system in the U.S. is like a balloon. You got something you push on one end, it's got to go somewhere else, right? So yeah, I'm anticipating that there's going to be ground piles, you know, pretty much all over the place. Logistics-wise, I don't know, it kind of ties back into some of the, you know, the questions that Arlen had brought up about China and their bean demand. And how much of that, how much of that grain is going to be leaving the kind of the northern tier out the PNW? I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that, honestly. But in overall, river transportation seems to be looking fairly good. The forecast, at least, I mean, it doesn't look like we're going to have a low water situation. Hopefully, fingers crossed. Rail seems to be working well, with the exception of maybe some of the issues in Mexico, with Ferromex getting cars and power back to the U.S. But I'm fairly optimistic, I guess, about our situation. That discounts everything else, all the global shipping issues. So we still have that, whether it's in the Red Sea or other other struggles, but. No, I think we're going to have a lot of grain on the ground, but hopefully the system works.
So anticipated, it's not a problem moving the crop. It's about putting it on the ground and storing the crop.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, that's, I guess, my bigger concern is that if we continue to see kind of slack export demand in beans, not necessarily slack, but just off. And we've had a really great export program in corn, so hopefully that continues. I mean, we really need to have those export markets, especially. I mean, we're very competitively priced right now, so I would hope that continues.
Matt, this is a conversation we've had many times in the last month and a half. This is going to be about the basis. You have experience, of course, in the elevator business. Putting a crop down on the ground, corn, is going to be an issue, particularly as it relates to storage space, because farmers are going to want to sell their beans across the scale, and we're going to talk about that in a second, but just basis is going to be an issue. And I think, how do you see that developing?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of my biggest concerns is a grower that, for instance, knows they've got 40, 50,000 bushels that has to go to town that they cannot store, and they don't know what they're going to do with it yet. I would just as soon have a plan for it now is to wait until October the 10th or 15th, because if you're putting corn on the ground, from my own personal experience, it's putting it on the ground's a little easier than picking it back up, and none of us enjoy doing it. And I can tell you, if you want to rain in central Illinois, now start piling corn on the ground somewhere, because that's when it starts raining, okay? And then you've got quality issues. And so I've been telling guys, don't get in a position where the elevator says you can deliver, but you're going to have to sell in order to deliver. And by the way, congratulations, there's a 50 under basis to go along with it. And I don't think that number is going to be too far off. We've already got some folks at 35 and 40 under in our part of the world. And I think 50 under or worse could happen in the thick of harvest. And so I don't want to get caught in that. And so the way I'm looking at this, the grower is still very much undersold on new crop corn. And some of your originators have told me that they're still willing to have a little bit of wiggle room on basis. Of course, it's going to probably be for quantity, but if you called your guy and said, hey, you know what, I've got 25, 30, 50,000 bushels, could you go from 3,500 to 25, 2,700? it has been happening. I know that. And so, you know, you at least have to take advantage, in my opinion, of having that ability to make that conversation happen right now, because I don't think you're going to get to have it once you get harvest going in full earnest.
So you are of a mind, just off the quick calculation, that basis depreciates somewhere between 15% and 20%?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if I'm just going to put cents on it, I'm going to say at least 10 to 15 cents. It could be 20. I think one thing that's going to maybe slow it from getting super wide is there's a whole lot of folks talking about bagging corn every year. More and more of them are bagging more and more corn. And so if you're going to bag the corn, obviously, it's going to take a little pressure off the system. And I have had a few originators tell me that they feel like two things. The crops probably, if it was a 188.8, Todd, I could have seen basis levels that would make your, you know, head explode. But you take that down just a little bit, it's going to take a little pressure off. And then, of course, guys finding another home for that corn, in my opinion, is going to make the elevator maybe not near as horrific as what we thought it might have been originally.
Arlen, I want to talk about basis a little bit, but I also want to talk about competition. The Safrina corn crop is coming out of Brazil. I think marketed into just about now, it should be coming in making it to port there, if I remember correctly. That's competition.
We are extremely competitive on the world market right now because Brazil farmers are not selling. They basically have finished harvesting the crop, but it's not moving. And on the way here earlier this week, I was on the phone while driving, talking to one of our top brokers in the Mato Grosso area. And I said, Jonas, when is the farmer there going to sell? What's his target? He said, they're waiting for the rally. They're waiting for the
sounds familiar
rally in the board. I said, just like the U.S. farmer then. And so they're behind and they're selling as well. And it's got their basis at extremely high levels because they're not selling. And that's why our exports are strong. The other reason our exports are strong, and I wanted to mention this, is a year ago we had 30,000 head of feeder cattle a week coming across the border out of Mexico in the United States to be fed here. And the border's closed now because of the New World screwworm. So we're exporting the corn to Mexico so they can feed the cattle down there, slaughter them, and send the beef up here. So USDA should have cut their feed usage number in August, on August 12th, and instead they bumped it another 250 million bushels. The numbers don't add up. And so, while there's a lot of positives out here, that's one you've got to be aware that as the crop gets smaller, demand is going to get smaller as well. USDA fluffed up that feed usage number, and that's going to shrink as the crop gets smaller. I don't want to be the big bear here on that, but here I say is the more basis falls at harvest time, the more it has the opportunity to recover and the person be able to capture it as long as they have a home for that corn that they planned ahead.
Did Jonas also tell you that when you asked when they would sell, it would be after they got back from the Farm Progress Show or about the same time that producers here are going to be forced to sell across the scale?
Yeah, absolutely. He's very familiar with the Farm Progress Show.
Yeah, a couple of things. Of course, Arlen and I have had a chance to talk together, seems like almost every day here lately. But one thing, and I don't know if you saw this, Todd, but you know, the Brazilian grower who'd made a lot of money in the last 20 years, they're on the struggle bus right now. And so I saw, I read a column the other day that one of the larger lenders in Brazil, 600,000 clients, about 20,000 of them are currently in default. And so, you know, one thing I've told a lot of growers looking forward, you know, is that this is a situation where if the U.S. farmer's having a hard time making money planting corn due to high fertilizer costs, high input costs, you know, we're not alone. We're not rowing in that boat alone. So whereas we know the grower's going to plant a lot of beans this year, you know, the verdict's out on what their appetite's going to be to ramp up corn acreage significantly if input costs, we don't get some sort of relief. And right now, from a fertilizer standpoint, you know, and Arlen's buddy Josh Linville would agree with me on this, because he's, it's why I have the opinion I have, because I talk to him all the time. I don't see a lot of relief on fertilizer. It's very concerning. And so I just want to go back to, you said, what are growers asking me? They're saying, what if I don't put my fertilizer on this fall? Can I expect it to be cheaper next spring? I'm very concerned with that mentality, Todd, and here's why. At some point, the focus, in my opinion, is going to shift to 26. And even without this big demand increase, you've got phenomenal world and U.S. demand for corn. And so if you take acreage down significantly due to liquidity concerns, due to high input costs, due to the natural shift on corn to beans to corn, guys, all of a sudden people are going to take a look at the balance sheet and say, we don't have the room to have a weather issue. So will we buy some acres? I don't know. Is it going to come from corn going up or beans going down? I don't know. But if you get a corn rally, I can assure you, fertilizer is not going to come down. Last point, real quick, sorry. 545 million bushel increase in demand on this report, okay? And so one thing Arlen and I have been trying to help people understand is that's a big jump, you know? And that's the protocol. USDA typically, if they increase production, they raise demand as well. And so if you go ahead and you take 5-6 bushel off this crop over the next two reports, you've got all the demand and then some to offset that if you want to. Now, there's reasons to believe that we could leave exports the same, but I'm with Arlen. This feed and residual, feed and residual, it gives them some wiggle room, you know. I think that they're going to have to dial that back. And so we've got to be cautious as to assume, hey, this is a 184.5 yield in September. I'm not saying that's what will happen, but if it was, these guys are going to say, this is bullish. I'd be careful in that assumption on old crop.
Yeah, because you're suggesting then at that point at Colander, what they're really suggesting is demand offsets whatever decrease in yield might come. So to make it easy, every bushel that it drops a million.
It probably won't be one for one, but good luck getting much under 2 billion.
Yeah. Yeah. So it yes, correct. So we don't change that very much.
No.
Do you see that, are you with them, because this is what you do, on the demand side being too heavy?
Well, obviously these guys are the experts, right? So I'm I feel like an interloper here, but my best guess is that yes, I do see opportunity in the export market, especially with how competitively priced the U.S. origin is right now. But that could certainly change, right? So it's really interesting in Brazil, how the acreage is changing. They're increasing their demand for corn ethanol, right? They're building more and more corn ethanol plants. So they're consuming a lot more of that corn right now. And they'll be competing in the ethanol exports, the distillers export markets as well, right? So that dynamic is interesting to me. And then also South America and Argentina, the policy changes that they're undertaking and reducing the export taxes and so forth. I am confident that we will see Argentina become a much stronger competitor in the world market coming on pretty soon. So that, I know it's a very mixed bag, and I honestly, I don't know that I have a really good answer, but I would defer to these guys. They know what they're talking about.
All right, we're going to get a final word from each of you at this point. I will say that if you're interested in the numbers from Brazil, I have a difficult time sometimes looking at them in metric tons because they always come in that way. You can go to willag.org. There is a tab there that says USDA. And the supply and demand tables for both corn and soybeans are converted, the actual S&D tables, into bushels. And I find it easier to think about it in that way. Arlen Suderman from StoneX, let's start with your final thoughts for our program.
I'd just like to highlight, be talking to your suppliers, be talking to your people who buy from you. Have the conversation so you can plan and don't get caught off guard.
Colin Waters from the Illinois Corn Growers Association.
Yeah, I guess the only thing that I would just add is a little bit on the input side of things. So the Illinois Corn Growers, we're just 100% focused on farmer profitability. We're working as hard as we can to help develop markets and expand markets. But we're also working on the input side. really trying to get as much relief as we possibly can. We're talking to the fertilizer companies, talking to the tech companies and everybody else, because, you know, honestly, there's a lot of policy stuff that's going on right now that could help or hurt on some level, like the $10 billion you know, emergency payment that came out last December. I don't know that it was a Band-Aid, right? But I don't know if that, I have a feeling that that's structurally not helpful for farmers, right? Because there's, you know, what input supplier, what landlord is going to say, oh yeah, I can see you're really having a hard time here when you just got a government check, right?
Possibly built into the fertilizer
and
price.
Until it fundamentally changes, I think we're going to be struggling. But we're working every day as hard as we can to help farmers.
And Matt Bennett from agmarket.net, your final word for the day.
I mean, there's no doubt this is a challenging environment. It's one of the most, probably the most challenging environment for a lot of folks younger than me. And so, you know, for me, I think we have to look at a couple of different things. And one of those is that we do have very strong corn demand. It's going to be a real feather in our cap moving forward. I think it's a very dynamic environment we've got with input costs. You know, we could see a bit of a pendulum swing over the next several months. And so I don't want to just put my head in the sand and do nothing here. If I'm have the ability to have a home for corn, like Arlen was talking, I certainly think that it's probably a smart idea. Look at the carries in the market. What can we do with this crop? Sell the carry, wait on basis to come back to you, handle it like our grain elevator does. I think it's something that we can have base hits and at least live to play another day, because it's not all lost.
Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. You may find and listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at willag.org. That's willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists today, Matt Bennett, Colin Waters, and Arlen Suderman. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.